Happy Halloween!
Great costume.
Are you like the British American Psycho or something?
This guy, man, the costume,
next level commitment.
Jesus! Oh, shit! That's an actual body. That's an actual body.
One of our guests is trying to kill us.
People wear masks their whole lives, pretending that life has meaning. When you kill somebody, all of that's gone.
How do you come to do what you do?
Choose a job you love. You never have to work a day in your life.
And happy Halloween.
I got a rock.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of the Everyday is Halloween podcast. I know you guys are so surprised after getting two shows in October and now a special show in November. And I told you guys that we're going to have a very special show this month. And I've ranted and raved for the past 2 to 3 months about a little film called The Body on Hulu right now. And we're going to do something different for this episode. I'm sitting next to Paul Davis. What's going on, sir?
Hey, how's it going?
Paul is the director and writer of The Body.
Co-writer. Give my props to Paul Fisher, who was the guy who brought the short film to me in the first place back in 2013.
Gotcha. Okay. Nice. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to do a live commentary. It's exclusive only to the Everyday Italian podcast for now. And what we'll do is we'll press play and we're going to run through the entire film. And you guys can do the same at home. Now, this is going to be a Hulu no ads run of the film. So that means if you have paid ads, it's going to kind of make things wonky for you as you're watching it. But if you pay that extra, what is it, like $7.99 or $12.99 for the full thing?
I have no idea.
Well, yes, if you pay that extra little bit of money, you'll be able to watch this without no ads. And I highly recommend that.
But we'll say when the ad break is hitting. So, you know, if you need to pause this and wait till the ads done, then you'll be set.
So. There you go. All right.
Okay, so we're going to press play now. Okay, so this was the little Into the Dark ident, which was the last thing that was completed. Also featuring the music by the Newton Brothers, who composed the music for The Body.
Oh, okay.
Very lucky to get those guys, who, of course, do all of Mike Flanagan's stuff. Great score on Haunting of Hill House on Netflix, which if you haven't seen is fantastic. So, yeah. Now,
I remember the first film that has that overhead shot that you were very proud of, the first
Correct.
Short.
Yeah, we wanted to replicate the opening shot of the short film, which I mentioned we made back in 2013, which started with this grand kind of Steadicam shot, which was setting up the little black and white movie in the background. There is Ghosts on the Loose from 1943 with Bela Lugosi and the East Side Kids. We wanted to do this kind of faux POV shot, very reminiscent of John Carpenter's Halloween. Which of course turns out not to be a POV shot, because once we reach this guy, we then cut to Wilkes sitting at the table eating his maggot cheese.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk to you about this. What's it like to act? Like, do you talk to the actor beforehand? Like, this is what we're gonna do, or was he all in for it?
He was all in for it, considering the maggots were CG.
Oh.
So he didn't actually have to eat maggots.
That's amazing CG. That's really good. Yeah, I thought it was.
And of course, the reference here is the handler on the phone is Alex Winter, Who you guys, of course, know, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but he was also Marco the Vampire in The Lost Boys, specifically the vampire that goes out to get the Chinese food for them, which turns out to be maggots, Michael. So that was our little nod to The Lost Boys, having a character eat maggots while talking to Alex Winter. So.
Love it. Now, was it like bringing him onto this? Like, was he one of your top picks?
Tom was interesting. I mean, we had a few people that were kind of on our like list of three or four people, and Tom was mentioned to me by my agent because we're at the same agency. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing a picture of him. I remembered him from Murder on the Orient Express, the Kenneth Branagh adaptation with Johnny Depp and Keira Knightley and Michelle Pfeiffer. And he played Book, who's the kind of like the playboy whose dad owns the rail, the train that they're on. And I thought that he was way too good looking for this character, because in the original short, it was Alfie Allen, and we wanted someone who had a very esoteric look.
Yeah.
You know, someone who's kind of like an odd duck inside and out. Mm-hmm. And I remember I showed the picture of him to my co-writer, Paul Fisher, and he said, well, no, he's the Disney version of Wilkes. He's way too good looking. But then I flew back to London to get my visa, and I met with him in the Soho Hotel, and he just absolutely charmed the hell out of me.
Yeah.
He was mesmerizing, and I knew that if he could do that to me, he could do that to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was important for him to be charming, because that's the huge difference between Wilkes in this version and the short. You know, we don't get to know him long enough in the 20-minute short, but in this he had to kind of be almost a mix between Travis Bickle and Alex Delage. Mm-hmm. You know, he had to get the audience on side, despite the fact that from the opening scene we tell you that this is not a good guy.
Yeah.
But he had to be likable, and Tom was. He was just, there was something about him that was just so magnetic, and I wanted to cast him there and then. So this shot in the lobby, I took directly from the opening of Reservoir Dogs, where they were walking away in slow motion and the title comes up.
It's nice to see it not just like, you know, right in the middle of your screen, you know. It's,
right.
It adds a little to it, you know.
Right. And these shots, I mean, we were shooting, trying to remember. So that was Grand Avenue in LA. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the first moment. It was the weird moment between, you know, making the short film 5 years previous to coming to this, standing in the middle of a street in LA thinking, holy shit, we just shut down an entire street in LA.
Right, yeah. We're now the cause of the industry right there, you know.
Exactly. Scott Winnig, who is my DIP, did a phenomenal job on this. And if you didn't spot the reference a minute ago just there, it's The Banana in the Tailpipe, Beverly Hills Cop. One of my favorite movies.
Hey, there's that guy.
But yeah, this was actually the last week of filming. So we shot a lot of it out of order. Because one of the big things with making this film, we really had to consolidate our locations. We had to be very careful about our locations, because we had a lot of locations in this, and this was an 18-day shoot for under $2 million. You know, so we really had to...
You got to stay tight.
We had to be very tight, yeah. One of the things that's actually extraordinary about this film is that, you know, we're recording this, 1st of November. This film still, as a script, still didn't exist this time last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was something that was done very, very quickly. We only turned in the script to my reps on the 16th of December last year and found out that we were making the film a week later. And then I was straight on a plane to Los Angeles meeting with Blumhouse and Hulu, and the deal was done, you know, super quick. And, you know, by the end of March, we were in hard prep and we started filming 2nd of May.
Okay.
So, you know, everything just happened super quick. And we were rewriting the script all the way up till, you know, first day of filming, you know, just chopping out locations. Because I think it started with like 17 places and ended up with 7 or 8.
Yeah.
So
I got to ask you something. The feet. Who worked on these disgusting looking feet?
So if I remember correctly, so I had, I called in a favor on this. One of my dear friends, Erin Kruger-McCash,
uh-huh.
who's a multi Emmy award winning makeup artist from American Horror Story, 9-1-1.
Oh, okay.
Effectively does all of Ryan Murphy's stuff.
Yeah.
I asked her if she would do the makeup in this.
Mm-hmm.
And we were originally, I mean, all of the effects in this were, the prosthetic effects were created by a wonderful effects artist called Vincent Van Dyke. He created all of a lot of the goriest stuff that you're going to see in the film. But there was an effects artist called, I think his name was Joel Harlow. Joel Harlow.
Mm-hmm.
Just worked on Neil Marshall's Hellboy.
Oh, nice.
It turned out that he had a body that wasn't being used. And he got in touch and said, look, we've got this thing. If you want it, you don't have to pay like 10 grand to make a new one.
Yeah.
So he had this dummy that had been used for another movie. I'm not going to say which, because one of the questions I keep getting asked is, well, who is the body?
Yeah.
And it was an actual dummy of an actor.
Right, yeah.
But I'm never going to tell you who it is.
Nice.
but the feet were created especially for this film.
Yeah, because, I mean, those are forefront next to the actor's face almost
exactly.
The entire film.
So. Yeah. And they looked and felt super real.
Yeah. Is that a Rick? That's not. Okay, those are Rick. No, Clive Barker?
Clive Barker.
Painting? No?
No.
Looked like it.
This place was really interesting, actually. We were looking for it. We looked at a lot of different places for Jack's party, and we saw this one relatively early on, and there we go, an unabashed cameo from Sasha Grey.
Yeah, that's
as the
fun.
DJ. I'll tell you the story of that right after this.
Which is great, because she plays herself.
She does, yeah, because she is a DJ. But yeah, this spot was really interesting. This was in downtown LA, and it was one of the lofts in the Fashion District. There you go, cameo Alyssa Dowling there from a bunch of horror movies. Yeah, we found this spot, and the thing that was really interesting about it is that the people who owned it said that they'd sign off on all the art in the room, and Jack is supposed to be this artist turned special effects artist turned virtual reality, you know, mogul.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of worked for the character, but what we loved about this place, and it wasn't in the script until we found this place, was the hidden room that they end up going in was actually a hidden room behind that wall.
Ah, okay.
So we thought, well, that is very Jack.
Yeah.
So we wrote it into the script. And they were really cool, but the thing that was really difficult about this day, so this...
I can only imagine the things that would have come up for a Halloween party.
Well, this was the day that everybody was stressing about, because this entire party sequence, we only had one day with all those background artists.
Oh, man.
So we had to get everything done.
I mean, costuming alone.
We had to get everything done in that one day with all these background artists. And of course, that's also the day that both the execs from Blumhouse and Hulu choose to come and visit
of course,
and see how
of
everything's
course.
Going.
Yeah.
So everybody was running around like crazy, just, you know, stressing about getting everything done.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but there was this masochistic part of me that really enjoyed that. So I was the only person on the set that was completely relaxed.
Yeah.
I love the fact that everybody was like crazed.
And you're like, hey.
Yeah, it made me more relaxed. And I kind of went into, because I had this large audience of extras, I kind of went into stand-up mode.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to make myself be entertaining as a director, as well as get the job done.
Right.
And it was funny, especially when we were shooting all the vignettes, like the moment which I just pointed out with Alyssa Dowling snorting the coke off the broccoli dude's head.
Yeah.
You know, those were just made up on the spot. You know, I saw the broccoli guy and I was like, right, him, sit down in front of these two. They're gonna snort coke off your head. You know, and all the background are looking at me like, what the fuck is this movie?
Yeah,
you know. Because they don't know what the story is. That's the thing. Nobody gets told what you're doing. You're just seeing what
you're in a Halloween party scene tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
so, and this scene was shot on the roof outside of the building where the kids bumped into him in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So again, just shot this and the underground parking garage and the lobby. You know, so you just plonk yourself into an area for 4 days
uh-huh.
before you then have to move on again.
Right.
You know.
I've been seeing photos of people actually dressing as her this Halloween.
There, yeah, this is really cool. We've had a couple of people dressed as Maggie. We've had a couple of people dressed as Wilkes. And today I woke up on Twitter and found someone that was Wilkes from the waist up and Maggie from the waist down.
Oh, my God. That's great.
Dragging a corpse around, which is pretty cool. So, no, you know, it's, I guess that's kind of the ultimate goal, to make something that people are then going to dress up as. It's really uncanny.
Yeah.
It's super flattering.
Uh-huh.
But,
so what do we know, like, know her from?
Okay, so she's Rebecca. A really good actress. Yeah, I met Rebecca on day one of casting. Everybody came through auditions apart from Tom. And she was the last person to come in on the first day. And she was, I mean, there were a lot of great people who read for the role and were very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But what was great about Rebecca is that there was just an honesty to her approach. And I think she kind of understood the fact that Maggie is this, you know, she's this oppressed, I don't want to say a damsel in distress, but she's just someone that's just fed up with the way that she's been treated in life and, you know, just needs that little push to break out. And her, you know, coming face to face with this guy and finding out what he does and the fact that he's so matter of fact about it and he treats it like a job. You know, it's, for her, it's kind of like, well, if he can do it, then so can I.
Yeah, she wants a part of that world.
Exactly, yeah. you know, and she's sick of being pushed around by, you know, men, basically. And one of the things that was really cool about this, with both Rebecca and Aurora Perrineau, who plays Dorothy, both Paul Fisher and I were very careful when we first met with them to say, look, this script was written by two dudes. You know, if there's anything in here that you don't agree with or you want us to change, call us out on our bullshit.
Yeah,
because we'll, you know, because we'll do it. And they were both great about that. And there was very little that we changed. In fact, when we, after the premiere at the LA Film Festival, I had two young ladies come up to me on separate occasions and say to me, that could have been written by a woman.
Yeah,
you know, and I was like, "Well, don't let the beard fool you."
Right.
You
know, I haven't been inside.
But that's, you know, that's such a great compliment, because, you know, it's,
yeah, you're reaching with your writing, you know.
Like, yeah, and you know, I think it's an important time in Hollywood right now for
big time,
you know, to be writing female characters like this, because, you know, if,
hey, this guy,
oh, that guy. So I must say, drink responsibly.
Yes.
Because this Friday the 13th shot challenge happened in real life.
Yes.
Hence why I immortalized it on film.
Yes. If you guys don't know right now, that is Paul sitting there doing shots with his buddy.
Yeah. Well, that's also Paul Fisher. That's the co-writer.
Yeah. Okay.
Who's with me? Yeah. Yeah, that really happened.
Right, in Manhattan too, yeah?
Well, no, in real life, I only got to part 7. I only got to the New Blood.
Were you shooting?
What
were you drinking?
Oh, what were we drinking? Yeah. In real life or there?
Or real life.
In real life, we were drinking Sambuca.
Sambuca, yeah. And that was?
That was iced tea, like iced tea, I think it was.
Yeah.
Like a sweet tea. And the vomit was like this Nesquik. It was like strawberry Nesquik with oatmeal.
Yeah.
Which oddly tasted a lot nicer than it should have. But no, Rebecca was absolutely fantastic. And I just love the way, I mean, even in her original reading, she was very inquisitive. She wasn't afraid to ask questions. And because it was so hot and sweaty in the room when we were doing the casting, you know, she came in like all smiles and, you know, friendly, kind of the way we're introduced to Maggie. And then because she was reading it and doing this really intense reading, first of all, of the scene that you just saw between Maggie and Wilkes on the balcony, and then a scene later in the bar. And she just took it from, you know, Cesar Romero's Joker to Heath Ledger in 30 seconds. So by the time she was finished, there was this intensity to her. And then she got up and she was like, get some effing AC in this place, and stormed out. And I was like, that's Maggie.
There you go.
She left on a mission.
That's so great.
And of course, Ray Santiago.
Yeah, I was gonna say, was he still on Ash vs. Evil Dead, or was that already over and this was like
Ash right after that? Think we found out that Ash vs. Evil Dead was cancelled. We'd already cast him at that point. Mm-hmm. But it was before we started filming that it was announced. And he was great. I mean, I do the Spielberg method of directing with actors, where I kind of go in and I was like, right, I want you to give me a 7 out of 10. But with Ray, it was like, okay, Ray, we're going to start this scene. I want you to give me 7 out of 10 because Jack has to be this very hyperactive, intense character anyway.
Yeah.
So I was like, give me a 7 out of 10, Ray. Uh-huh. And then we'd do the first take and I'd go back over to give my note. I was like, right, we're going to need to take it down to a 2. But
he has very intense features.
Yeah,
you know?
But you know, he was, you know, he was so professional and and he was so committed and dedicated to getting into that headspace that Jack needs to be, you know, and with all of them as well, you know, because one of the things that we didn't kind of hammer home but tried to make obvious is that these guys are high and they're drunk, hence a lot of stupid decisions they make.
Yeah,
You know, because we've all been on a night out where we've done things that probably should have thought about a lot harder. You know? And the thing with Ray, you know, every time we go to do a take, I'd turn around and he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd look all around and he's sprinting like the perimeter of wherever we are.
Uh-huh.
So that when he comes back, he's all amped up and hyper. And,
oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Very good at improv as well. He never did the same. He never said the same thing in multiple takes.
Yeah.
So, but that was my editor's problem.
Sure, definitely. Enjoy this.
This was a very difficult room to shoot in, because, like I said, this literally was a small room in that same location behind a hidden wall. So any other smart people would have shot this scene in a studio where we had wild walls and could have had lights above, but...
Were you all just pressed against the other walls?
Yeah, we were always just pressed into what little space we could find with all those people in that room, and we had to relight every shot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were in this room for 2 days. That's how...
Wow.
You know, and it's only a short scene, but...
Now, how do you get? You just go to a props department and say you want like special effects stuff for the room itself?
No, that's all the set decoration. Our production designer on this was Cecil Gentry, and he was great. Mm-hmm. He totally got the vibe. He knew that it needed to scream Halloween.
Yeah,
you know, you know, like even in finding this location, you know, the wall tiles are very Blade Runner, you know. But yeah, we just, you know, he knew the character and he knew what, you know, the kind of person that was. You know, that Jack was this kind of obnoxious, kind of trust fund artist kid. So he's going to have a lot of, you know, material goods and whatnot.
So let me ask you about the one scene where the feet move. Did you have somebody just get their ankles wrapped up?
We did.
Yeah.
We did. We had someone wrapped from the waist down. And what was funny about that, because that was towards the end of the day and, you know, we were really pushing it to get what we needed. And I was talking the guy who was our stunt body. I was, you know, telling him what I wanted from him. And they were wrapping it up, and they were like, okay, let's frame up, because we were going to shoot it from the other side. So there you're seeing it shot from the left ankle, looking at the left ankle.
Right.
Originally, it was supposed to be from the right. And then we got the camera up, and I went over to the monitor, and the guy had a tattoo on his ankle.
So, not going to mention that at all before
we do this. I was like, did anybody think to mention this?
Jeez.
So, I mean, bless. I mean, the makeup department tried to cover it up, but you know, just in the 10 minutes that it took to wrap up the legs, you know, it had already started to come through. So yeah, we just ended up shooting it from the other side. So this was this moment was always kind of like my money shot in the short, you know, just that group of people, and you know, of course you can, which we shot in a very similar way to the short. And this speech was always in every draft of the script that we wrote, and And I'm not going to take any of the credit for this. All of the kind of like Wilkes intense monologue moments was 100% Paul Fisher. Because I remember reading it for the first time and just thinking,
you're like, this is good. I'm not touching this. Yeah. Now, how, whenever that scene where you see the blood pool in the plastic, is that like a CG thing or is that a one take? Or?
That was a mixture of both. So Mike McCash, who's Erin's husband, who works with her on all their stuff together, and is a fantastic artist.
Mm-hmm.
He created a tube with a pump gag. So we had the physical blood in there, and it was just a case of testing it and seeing, you know, how much we needed to get that right amount of cover of blood, you know, on the face. And I think we did two takes. Of that, and we had someone with a broomstick handle underneath the head to kind of, so it was like 1, 2, 3, go. So as Mike hit the pump, he jolted the head, so it looked as though it was coughing.
Nice.
That's
great.
And yeah, we did two takes of that, and I think there's a little bit of CG enhancement on the blood. But
the CG cover-up's good, because I didn't even realize that the maggots were CG from the blood, the CG. Like, I would have had no idea that any CG was even put in
there. Dude, even the opening skyline shot of LA is CG. That was shot on, like, the ground floor of a common room in a...
Oh, my God.
In a downtown building. So, yeah, they had to go out and shoot a plate of the skyline. This moment with the escape room was something that came in very late. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we only wrote in the hidden room aspect once we found that location. But this moment we always kind of got stuck on in the script. It's like, how are we going to separate them?
Gotcha.
And this was something that Paul Fisher came up with after we discovered the hidden room aspect. Because I think in an earlier version, we just had her kind of lunge at him, and because she was making out with him, it was the distraction and something like that. But it just didn't feel right for the character.
Yeah.
It felt too early for anything like that, you know?
Yeah. And then, I mean, it also keeps it kind of the horror theme, the scary clowns coming down, you know, Halloween party, so...
Yeah.
We just had a long dialogue scene, so it kind of breaks up that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And again, this was a moment that came very, very late, because the DJ character didn't really have a function in earlier drafts. It wasn't until we did this whole big entrance for Jack, which Blumhouse really wanted to do, and I thought was smart, because, you know, this is kind of the party sequence is really what sells the holiday.
Yeah,
you know, because once you leave the building, it's only kind of brought back in dribs and drabs, like when they end up in the bar. So we're at the first ad break, by the way.
First ad break.
And we've just come back, and Wilkes is trapped in the room. That was my split diopter shot.
Love it.
I watched Carrie the night before, and it's like, I want to do that.
Yeah. You got rid of your blurred line? You didn't have to worry about that one?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. Once we colored it, because we knew this scene was going to be dark.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that you weren't gonna see it really.
Good.
So, and I love the blue. It's almost giving her like a blue outline, which is gorgeous. Like I said, Scott Winnig, who's the DP on this, did a phenomenal job, I mean, especially trying to make that room look interesting.
Because
I think it was production designer Cecil who put the blue lights up.
Mm-hmm.
But. He
has that Guillermo del Toro thing where he wants to have stars in his house at all times. It's raining, you know.
There you go. I love this music cue. Like I said at the beginning, the Newton brothers did a fantastic job with this, because we wanted to do something that was kind of like Stranger Things.
Yeah, the same. What was the? Yeah, that's what you're kind of going for.
Yeah, it was very synth influenced. But I always remember when we were talking, especially with Blumhouse as well. It was almost as though, you know, the group have to have their own theme. And I always got worried every time they said, it has to be fun, you know, it has to be a fun theme. And I was like, what? Not like, okay, these are the funny guys, like comedy music. And I was always worried about what was going to come back. And then I heard this cue for the first time and I just hugged both. I just hugged the Newtons because it was good.
Yeah.
It was so good. So yeah, this scene in particular, I remember being a very hairy day on set, and it's all to do with that book, because
it had to be that book.
It was all to do with that book. Well, it was written in the script that it was The Count of Monte Cristo, because it's a classic story with like an epic prison escape scene. So it's Jack playing the joke of hiding the keypad inside that, because it's what's going to get you out of the room.
Yeah.
But originally, if you watch this scene back, there are two bookshelves. So there's the one behind Maggie there, which is in the far side of the room, which is what we were lit for. Everything was lit for the back of the room. But we knew that we had to go to the front bookshelf because that's originally where the book was, which meant completely relighting it. And everybody was worried, and they all went off to lunch. And I just sat in the room, and I was just looking at the two bookshelves. And I just walked up to it and I grabbed the book and I put it on the bookshelf at the back. And Scott Winning came back from lunch. He's like, "Why are you smiling?" And I just pointed to the bookshelf with the book in it. He just turned to me and went, "Dude, you just saved us 2 hours."
Yeah, no need for setups
anymore. There you go. I always enjoyed shooting these scenes with these guys. They had such great chemistry together.
Yeah.
Because none of them knew each other before starting this. Mm-hmm. And they're now like best friends off set.
Oh, that's great.
Really cool. We called them the Scooby Gang on the set.
Now, the security guard, I've been seeing him on Twitter advocating the film and stuff too.
Max, who played Officer Randy Freer, which no one picked up on the fact that Randy Freer is the owner of Hulu. Ah. Even Hulu didn't pick up on that. So that was our little nod to our supreme overlords of Hulu. You know, Max was great. He originally auditioned for Alan, and I loved David Hull's interpretation of the character. There were moments in David's audition that he improv'd that we loved so much that we ended up writing in the script. So we knew that we wanted David, but we were very impressed with Max as well. So I suggested, well, why don't we have him read for Officer Freer? And he did, and was just great. Because there's an element of the character that's kind of like, well, he's obviously someone who was bullied in school that's now doing the cop power play.
Right.
But doesn't really have it in him. You know,
he's still going to go along with what everybody's saying.
Yeah. He's a softie at heart, and Max just had that, and he was so great. Oh, references.
Hey.
I remember when Rebecca said to me, "What is THX?" No, she was like, "Yeah, she originally said it's THX 1138," and I was like, "No, Rebecca, it's THX 1138."
Uh-huh.
And she was like, "What's that?" And I was like, "Well, it's George Lucas's first movie, obviously." Mm-hmm. And she looked at me like, "Well, obviously,
obviously."
You know? And then I think, "Oh yeah, not everybody's a nerd,
right?
Like me."
But I like that her character would know that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, she hangs around with Jack so much. That's, that's the thing, you know? Aurora was so good. She was so good. One of the things that was great about each of these three characters is that in their real personalities, there was an element of their character, like the tiniest element of their characters.
Yeah.
So they are exaggerated versions of themselves, which is why they're so good at it.
Uh-huh.
That shot was completely by accident, by the way. The fact that his hand was covering the face.
Oh, yeah.
That was just a happy accident. So.
He's famous. Yeah. And rich.
Yeah. So we did about 8 multiple versions of this reveal and what their reaction was. And when the cast saw that I chose that version. They were like, really?
Yeah, like we sat there and got everybody's reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fun. And this was fun to shoot.
I remember. Is that a wingsuit of the movie P2?
No. No, that's funnily enough, not a reference. But I just remember Chief Wiggum. I just remember when we were shooting this moment. I was like, Tom, it's ready for you to come be the T-1000.
Oh yeah. And,
like, hey, that shot in particular was very T-1000. One take.
Oh, there it is.
That's all we had. The genius of Mike McCash. There was one little moment when we were setting it up, because he's Max, who played Officer Freer, was wearing a white T-shirt underneath, and the blood from the appliance started to drip onto the T-shirt before we'd even shot anything.
No. Oh, yeah.
But the genius of Mike McCash, he went to the wardrobe department and said, "Does he have a spare?" And they were like, "Yeah, but you know, he can't change." He's like, "No, I don't need that. Just give me the spare T-shirt."
Yeah.
And he cut the collar off. And just put it over the top.
There you go.
Absolutely. He's saved us. Oh,
I mean, that's the beauty of on-the-ground filmmaking is just if you can, like you said, like the bookshelf thing.
Right.
You know, like if you can like cut out 2 to 3 hours of filming, I mean, it saves you so much and everybody painstakingly time, you know? Like
That's the thing. You know, a lot of filmmaking is thinking on your feet. You can go in super prepared, but every day you're going to get a curveball and you don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, and... You know, 85% to 90% of my job is having answers.
Yeah.
You know, that when he says flesh wound, that was me trying to do like a horror incarnate reference to Monty Python.
Yeah.
It's a flesh wound.
Now, who threw the Ralph Wiggum comment in there?
That was Paul Fisher.
Yeah,
he wrote that line. Yeah.
It's great because Simpsons are on Hulu, so it works out
there
well.
There you go. Yeah, I always loved David Hall has got some of my favorite lines in this. And he says, "Oh my god, I've never been this close to a famous person before." You know what? We're not rescuing him because he's dead. Okay, whatever. Can we get it off the street? Okay. Why couldn't you just kill like Elijah Wood or someone small? See, now I have to clarify something with this. That reference is twofold. Number one, we know that it's not Elijah Wood. We're not saying we wish that Elijah Wood was dead.
Right.
You know. And I actually threw that in. That was a very obscure reference in the sense that the original short premiered in the US at Fantastic Fest in 2013.
Okay.
And when I was there, I met Elijah Wood for the first time. We were in the same shuttle bus from the hotel. Yeah.
Was he doing Maniac at the time?
No, I think it was... I mean, I think he goes every year anyway, but
yeah.
I think it was the same year as Open Windows, the Nacho Vigalondo movie. Mm-hmm. Or it was the same year... What was the... Was it Grand Piano?
Grand Piano... I don't know.
Was that the name of that movie?
Which
one? I don't know. It was an Elijah Wood where he was the piano player. Which also had Alex Winter in it.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. Anyway, so he was there, and we got talking in the shuttle bus, and it was strange, you know, because you know, it's this guy you idolize from the Lord of the Rings movies and stuff like that, and he was the first kind of celebrity that I'd met who seemed genuinely invested.
Yeah.
In everything that I was saying. It wasn't just, okay, we're in the same car, we have to talk, kind of thing.
Yeah, he was like, somebody that's actually, like, have a conversation
absolutely.
With.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was absolutely lovely, and I saw him later in the bar that day, and we had a picture together, and then we stayed in touch over Twitter and email, and I just never forgot that.
Yeah.
So, in essence, the Elijah Wood line was
like a high five.
It was a high five to both Elijah and also the beginnings of the short.
Yeah,
you know. So that comment was done entirely out of love. I think he's a wonderful guy, and I love what he does. So.
Awesome.
This was the first scene that I shot with these guys.
Oh yeah.
It's so much fun. And if there are any UK fans or US fans that are into I'm Alan Partridge,
mm-hmm.
the tarp in the background says Cook Pass Babtridge on it, which is a reference to the first episode of I'm Alan Partridge where his car gets vandalized and they write Cock Piss Partridge on it.
Uh-huh.
But to cover it up, he changes it to Cook Past Babtridge. So that's it written there on the blue tarp.
That's great. So,
nobody on the crew had a clue what I was talking about, but yeah, they did it.
So, I love that.
I love that shot. I mean, again, the way that Scott Winnig lit and photographed this was beautiful.
Yeah, I was going to say, the gaffing on the street looks amazing.
Yeah, we shot this on the Panasonic Vericam because we knew that we had a lot of night exteriors to mm-hmm. do. So we looked at the Vericam because it's the same camera they used to shoot The Deuce on HBO.
Okay.
And also Ozark. And those are two movies that have a lot of night stuff but look gorgeous. And
yeah, it just captures light strong.
Yeah, and we wanted to... We didn't want to do something that was very... that looked like Collateral.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, you've got that whole hitman dynamic. We wanted something that essentially looked like Halloween, so it's got a very, it's got a very high sodium
definitely
look to it, which we could do very well with the Vericam, and we had very little lighting
mm-hmm.
for these kind of scenes. But I think Scott did a wonderful job.
Because everybody's pitching an app, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's... This scene was a lot longer, but we cut it down for pacing because mm-hmm. I felt like this was one of the scenes. It was suggested at maybe throwing in another intercut.
Yeah.
Back to Wilkes and Maggie, but I kind of felt that to keep the stakes raised, that we needed to stay with them from the moment they start bugging out to the fact that, or to the idea that they have a plan,
mm-hmm.
or that, you know, they know what they're going to do, whether or not they know how to do it.
Right, yeah.
And this was just so much fun to shoot. It's watching this film with an audience. This moment,
yeah,
when it cuts back to them, the place always goes nuts. We chop them into pieces small enough that they can't be recognized as human in case somebody finds one. Vinegar to soften the bones, we put each part in a different plastic bag, fill them with lye, tie the tops, and we bury them as far away from each other as possible. Say what?
Score dead. Just...
There you go.
Everybody in Hollywood.
There you go.
Breaking Bad is the echelon.
Yeah, I'd argue The Sopranos, but
sure,
fine.
Yeah,
that's fine. It's Alan.
Well, I just love that the makeup effects artist is even like, the fuck, dude. Like, I wouldn't even.
Exactly. Exactly. We did originally do a shot from the other side of the street that was in profile, so as he pushed away the camera went behind a car
mm-hmm.
and then we then shot the beginning of this scene coming out from the front of the same car and
it
panned
okay.
to reveal in this shot actually
mm-hmm.
The two shot of them walking towards the camera, but we couldn't get it quite
connected.
Yeah, it just didn't quite work. We tried
mm-hmm.
but luckily we had that lovely b-roll of the moon that we could throw in.
Yeah, that was good. So. Was it? And that wasn't CG either?
No, wow. That was the actual moon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This was a fun night. This was the second day of shooting. And God bless my producer Alexa Fagan on this. I absolutely love her to death. Mm-hmm. But there were moments where I just had to say, look, trust me, I know what I'm doing. So this shot here, I intended it to be very dark and in silhouette, because I'm a big fan of Danny Boyle, and specifically Trainspotting is one of my favorite movies. And there's that little moment where Begbie accidentally slices the guy's hand in the pub at the end, and he asks Ewan McGregor to come and get him a cigarette, and it's shot entirely in silhouette. So I wanted to kind of match that.
Yeah, that's good. I like the when he like strikes the it has it. It
lights him up, and I just remember Alexa going, "I want to see my actors." I was like, "We will." That's Ali Gortz, who's the editor of Mad Magazine.
Oh, it's Ali.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, she always is posting really fun songs on social media.
Yeah, this was one of her songs that I think she recorded about 5 years ago, which was kind of a nice serendipitous connection, because the short was made 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But I said to her, I got in touch with her. Originally, she was going to be playing a busker in an original draft. But her part kept getting cut by the producers, but every time it got cut, I found a new place to put her.
That's good,
because I didn't want to lose her from it. Oh, the guy at the bar is dressed from Rob Reiner from his episode of South Park.
That's great.
I put some really weird shit in this.
Well, she also, is she dressed from Blade Runner?
She's dressed as Pris from Blade Runner. Okay. Her mic stand is a severed arm, which is a nod to the band in From Dusk Till Dawn when they turn into vampires.
Love it.
But yeah, she came in and did one take of the song, and it was production sound as well, so she wasn't it wasn't a lip sync. She just played it live, and that was it. She was done.
You guys definitely gave her a good moment for the film, you know. It's not just rushed and thrown away.
And of course this was also day two, and we just had two cameras. We had two cameras set up in the respective bathrooms, and I was just directing them through a walkie-talkie, and of course,
hey,
the obligatory cameo, Mr. John Landis, without whom I would not have a career.
Which is great, because like I've already seen the GIFs. I think like the day the movie came out, the next day there was already GIFs of it.
Yeah, yeah, I told him. I was like, John, you're already a GIF. He was like, what's that?
You guys don't know that I met Paul and John the same day. So it's cool to see that, you know, you gave him that moment for the movie.
Well, he put me in his movie Burke and Hare with Simon Pegg and Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
And in the opening 5 minutes, I had my leg cut off by Tim Curry.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of feel like I needed to repay the favor by putting him in the men's room.
For sure, yeah.
So, but he was fun. He definitely kind of lifted spirits, you know, that early on in the shoot as well, which is kind of cool. Oh, note, never let me name a store in a movie. Seriously, next will be the lamp shop, sell you light. So, yeah, never let me name a store. And this, again, what I was talking about with regard to locations and really using the space that we were in, the bar is literally across the street.
Oh, wow.
The bar that they're in. So if they just walked out now, they'd see them.
Wow. So, I love that.
So I remember that was at the very end of that first night that I shot with those guys. Mm-hmm. We got so close to the wire, we could see the sun coming up, and we were doing two setups at once just to get it. So...
Not stressful at all.
Not stressful at all. one of the fun aspects of filmmaking. This was day one. This was the first thing that we shot. And I think it was a good decision by our assistant director. To start with I think it was something like 10 pages of dialogue, which was the first day. But it kind of established established the chemistry.
Definitely,
between these two, which I think is just it. Like I said, you know, I kind of felt like Maggie when I sat down and spoke to Tom for the first time. So, you know, and I think that the dynamic between the two is definitely there on camera. This was a fun little shot. It was me carrying over my love of Steadicam from the short, because we didn't have the Steadicam a lot. So, this is my RoboCop shot.
Nice.
Which then goes back into the Kill Bill shot.
Yep. Love it.
I remember driving my DP, Scott Winnig, nuts. I should stop saying my. I read Lee Winnell's tweet the other day. stop being possessive. The DP, Scott Winnig. I would drive him nuts when we were doing the shot list.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I want to do a shot. You know, do you remember that shot in Phantom of the Paradise or, you know, Tim Burton's Batman? And he'd just sit back in his chair and go, dude, no. Describe it. You know. This is the Edgar Wright edit.
Yeah, I love it.
There you go. That's,
It's just a fun scene transition, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to do something fun with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I always enjoy when I see laptops in movies and they have something over the Apple logo. Was that whose choice? Just
that was already covered up by the time it came to set.
Gotcha. So yeah,
I didn't question it. Well, I was, you know, for me, it was just kind of like my relationship with a lot of the producers who were dealing with that side of things was just them telling me what we couldn't have,
sure,
and then just changing it.
Yeah,
you know.
Taking faith in everybody else.
Taking faith in everybody, yeah. You know, it just kind of leaves you the scope to just stay creative. And
yes, keep your mind where it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Who paid you? So, this was a scene that went through a lot of transition when we were writing. It was because a lot of the earlier drafts, it was more about the playful kind of question and answer.
Mm-hmm.
Dynamic, but we wanted to. We kind of used it as an avenue to learn more about Maggie, because you still don't really learn anything about Wilkes, and I kind of like it that way. That was very deliberate in the terms of, you know, if you're going by Halloween 1, why is Michael Myers doing what he's doing? Doesn't matter. He's just doing it, and that's what's scary. The blocking of this scene and the shot choices was. Was mimicked from the Jackrabbit Slim
mm-hmm.
conversation between Uma Thurman and John Travolta.
Yeah.
I always loved the way that was shot. You know, because at the end of the day, it's two people sitting down talking.
Right.
You know, so how do you make it interesting?
Mm-hmm. I love the blue jack-o'-lantern in the back.
Yeah, again, this was...
Candelabra.
Just, yeah, it was just another instance where Scott, the DP, and Cecil, the production designer, were just so on point.
Mm-hmm.
And there was great communication between every department on this. You know, everybody knew what they needed to do,
yeah.
You know, and what the scene needed to be. They knew the beats, they knew the feel, they knew the vibe, and everybody mm-hmm. just connected on that. So. With regard to the music in the bar, I just said to the new... They said, what do you want? I was like, give me Steely Dan.
Yeah.
Dad rock. Let's go with Dad rock. So this was the moment that Rebecca did in her audition that won me over.
Mm-hmm.
Because she just took it to that level of someone that's obviously just been wronged so many times, just been stepped on.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have to use the word crazy. You know, because I never kind of view Maggie as crazy.
Yeah,
you know,
she just knows what she wants.
Yeah, she's just, she's a very determined human being.
Mm-hmm. Which is great, because it's just one of those things where it's like, if you are at a Halloween party or a party in general, you never know who you're meeting for the first time. You know, exactly. That person can kill you that night.
Exactly. And this sequence in particular, I mean, when I tell people that what Paul Fisher and I attempted to do, because I've read some reviews that have said that, you know, this is just a generic slasher film, which is more hurtful than anything else that I've read. I even woke up to one Twitter tweet this morning that said that this was like the worst piece of shit that they've ever seen, but that's fine. But
when you call it movies,
right, when you call it a generic slasher film, we essentially, you know, Paul Fisher and I, we're fans of classic Hollywood, so to us it was, when we set upon expanding this from a short film to a feature, which we spoke about for almost a year before we even started writing anything or writing down any ideas. The one thing that really intrigued us was trying to create a classic kind of Frank Capra, Billy Wilder, screwball comedy relationship between a serial killer and a girl that's just trying to find her feet in the world, trying to find her place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we watched It Happen One Night, Arsenic and Old Lace, Our Man Godfrey, you know, all those kind of movies, His Girl Friday, Bringing Up Baby. Mm-hmm. And it was those kind of characters that we thought would be a fun way to develop and embellish the relationship.
Yeah.
You know, so there is really this kind of It Happened One Night with blood kind of
thing. Uh-huh.
You know, and then you've got the Abbott and Costello element that's happening across the street.
Yeah.
You know. But those are the movies that really inspired us, you know. And I think the two kind of more modern films that, that definitely helped us in terms of how our narrative was going to play out were After Hours, which I think is, you know, Scorsese's most criminally underrated films.
Yeah.
Which was nearly directed by Tim Burton, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. And the other being The Terminator.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that it's this really bizarre cat and mouse movie set over a really bizarre night.
Yeah.
You know. Those guys. So there's a reference with regard to the priests as well, but I'll tell you when the cops come in, because that's where the reference kind of really comes full circle. Doing all this stuff with the laptop, though. Again, it's one of those things. It's like, how do you make people
engaging when they're on the computer?
Look at a laptop being, you know, interesting.
Yeah. Actuator.
There
they are. Okay. Now we can take the
car. The CG guys did really good on this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, that's all CG.
Yeah.
It wasn't stuff, you know.
Yeah, it definitely looks good.
It was putting my faith in these wonderful actors dealing with
blank screen.
Yeah, you know, George Lucas School of Acting.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Me too.
Find the video, run and delete it.
Again, this is just Maggie. Just.
We should send it to
them. We've already seen her take the pictures and.
We've already sent the photos.
She's engaged at this point,
and
she wants to be, which I think is the important part. Okay, so these two cops. First of all, I mean, I know he's sitting down, so he probably can't see it so well, but they have special officer written on their arms.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're not real cops. That's my little reference to Buster Rhymes, Halloween Resurrection. But, so the reason that you have the two cops going over to meet with the two priests, that was a little nod to something that we did in the short film. I'm unashamedly a fan of Hal Needham movies, especially Cannibal Run 1 and 2.
Yeah.
So they are a nod to Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin in the first two movies. Because in the first movie, they were dressed as priests. In the second movie, they were dressed as cops.
Cops, okay.
So.
Oh, shit.
This was, it was interesting showing the first screening. The place that we filmed all this in didn't look like this. This was something that was dramatically changed by the color correction.
Yeah,
because it just looked like a very bright kind of yellow warehouse room.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were sitting there, you know, we thought, well, it'd be logical that they wouldn't turn on any lights because
they've
broken into this place.
Uh-huh.
You know.
So is that yellow, does that blow out the entire shot, or are they able to like...
Yeah, well, it was just very bright in general. I mean, if you see any of the behind-the-scenes shots that I've posted, there's one picture I've posted in particular in this room and those pictures look exactly how this looked before we treated it. And
yeah.
It just looks like a room where all the light is bouncing off of these cardboard boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that Elsa from Frozen joke again. Every screening that we've done, that line.
Yeah.
You got another little nod coming up to one of our fallen soldiers of the horror genre.
Yeah.
This is where Alan mentions Hooper Street. Which, of course, is our little tribute to Toby Hooper.
Yeah.
But there are two others as well. So the cop earlier, his partner is called Wes, so it's Wes Craven. And this one's even harder to spot, but when Maggie's scrolling through the contacts on Jack's phone to send the pictures to Alan for the first time, the name underneath Alan's in the contacts is A. Romero.
I was going to say, yeah, I have Romero in there, yeah. You know, Paul, I feel like that's something in every film. You should throw those three guys in there, you know, some way, even if it's in the most minute, you know.
Well, I remember when... there you go.
Hey.
Little nod to Toby. When I got talking, because Sony picked up the international rights for this, and I told them, I was like, well, there's like 68 or 70 references to other movies. And they, no. They were like, really? Do you have a list?
Oh,
and I was like, no, but I can make one.
Sure, yeah.
So I sat through the movie and I wrote down it. I even rolled my own eyes at myself, you know, just. Because a lot of it I just made up on the day.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, this is from that movie that I love. Let's do it.
And right.
It turned out to be so many. But the thing is, unless you... I don't think there's any in there that are particularly... You know, they don't take you out of the film.
Right, yeah. It's not grossly, like, advertising or something. Yeah. It's just, like, a quick, like...
You know, I think those that are really, you know... in your face are the ones that are supposed to be.
Right.
You know, like Jack dressed as... Hannibal Lecter and, and stuff like that. This was a fun night.
The cemetery?
Yeah.
Now, which cemetery is this?
So this, again, you know, talk about being smart with the locations. Oh, just a little note. When we did the last take of this foot shot... we ran up behind them with Staying Alive playing on the phone. Yeah. I think we were all delirious by the end of the night. So had a little bit of fun with it. But so this was all in Altadena in California.
Okay.
So that's where the cemetery, the funeral home, and the mausoleum was all in the same place.
Oh, nice.
Because, again, the graveyard... wasn't in the script. You know, this was all supposed to happen because we found there was a funeral home that we found in LA that was literally just like off the street.
Yeah.
So you could go from like where the hardware store was, just go a couple of blocks, and there would be a funeral home.
Yeah.
But then we found when we went to Altadena to look at this funeral home, there was this beautiful grand cemetery. And we just all kind of looked at each other and it's like, okay, well, the scene where what is about to happen to Maggie happens, it should be somewhere epic.
Yeah,
it should be this
grandiose.
It should be this big operatic moment. Where better to do that?
Which is great because, you know, I've seen the original and it's now thinking of the body, like, this is the play. I mean, even the poster.
Right.
You know, it takes place here. So.
Yeah. It's... And we just found this wonderful... Originally it was in the street and he stabbed her by a bus stop. And I was thinking like the poster for La La Land. That was like my vision for that original version. So it was the lamppost and the bench, you know. And then he'd kill her and he'd sit her down.
Yeah.
And we just found this wonderful monument in the middle of the cemetery that had these marble benches with this giant kind of like Gaelic cross. With a huge Tim Burton tree behind it. And I was like, well, we're definitely shooting it at this spot. You know, and this was the one day that I got to use a crane on set.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, so I used the shit out of it. But yeah, this was a fun scene to shoot.
I love this moment where it's just, you know, there's always something up. Who's going to portray right. who at some point? Or like, are they just going to give in and it's going to turn cheesy? You
right,
know?
Right. And I think also for Paul and I, when we were writing this, we conceded to the fact that, you know, people are either going to see it coming or they're not. Mm-hmm. So how do we appease both sides of the coin?
Yeah.
So for us, I mean, and then of course you've got the other twist that comes later,
mm-hmm.
which again, a lot of people have said, well, I saw that coming. It was so obvious. Well, for us, it was, well, yeah, okay, if you saw it coming, mm-hmm. but isn't half of it the fun of waiting for it to happen?
Right.
If you know it's coming.
If you know it's coming, yeah, you must see it done beautifully.
Exactly.
You know, done well.
Exactly, because I remember when this premiered at the LA Film Festival, and again, I'm just saying this now, assuming that people have seen this already, otherwise, why the hell are you listening to us?
Right.
you know, when she comes back at the end, you know, that moment where Wilkes drops out of frame and she's standing there with the gun,
mm-hmm.
the place went nuts.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of get the impression that people either knew it was coming or were hoping
mm-hmm.
that it was coming.
Right, yeah.
You know, and that for us, that's my favorite shot in the movie.
Yeah, it's good.
I remember someone had the audacity to ask me whether or not her tear was CGI. I was like, no, that's acting.
Right, yeah.
Rebecca's just that good.
Yeah, that's a great shot.
So it's the second ad break.
Gotcha.
We've lost Maggie. She's gone.
Aww. Well, you know...
And then we come straight back into a Phantasm reference. Angus and Sons.
They made that up specifically
yeah.
in the script? That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah, I think that was made out of styrofoam.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, there you go. There's another reference. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This was a very stressful night. Something happened, you know, not pointing fingers at anybody, but the light, the key light that we needed to light this exterior
mm-hmm.
didn't turn up for 3 hours.
Oh,
so
no.
We were kind of twiddling our thumbs.
Mm-hmm.
And we then had to get them inside the mausoleum. So all that stuff inside the mausoleum was shot in the same night.
Oh, man.
So.
Handle the knife.
Yeah. I love the way he just throws the bomb.
Fuck it.
We did one take, which was actually in my original director's cut for all of 10 minutes
mm-hmm.
until I realized that this moment really doesn't require too much being funny.
Mm-hmm.
When Ray grabs the door. And pulls the door shut. On the first take, he grabbed hold of the door handle and his feet just went from under him. So he was hanging onto the door handle and then got up and pulled the door shut. And I had it in the movie for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then we decided to go a little bit more serious.
You know, 7, yeah. 10, you know, go back to 2.
So this moment we did... for two reasons. Well, it's partially the same reason, but for two reasons. So we just had the epic moment in the cemetery where you had the big Hollywood kiss.
Yeah.
And then you got this moment, which happens in a lot of slasher films.
Right, yeah, the other two.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, you know, the kids that you're supposed to be rooting for, they
yeah.
do just kiss. And you're thinking, but you're being... chased by someone right now, you know,
yeah.
someone's trying to kill you.
Not now.
Yeah,
not
exactly. Now. So, and we felt that Dorothy was that kind of character that would logically just
right
do that.
Bitch, please,
exactly.
Like hand it right in the face.
Exactly.
Which, you know, I was like, I mean, he is basically. I mean, he was written to be like the jerky character,
yeah.
right? I mean, he has the hashtag me
exactly
shirt, which says
exactly.
everything, you know. But for some reason, you still like him.
Right.
You know, like...
Yeah. Well, that was the thing, and I think originally, I think the choice of dialogue they chose for his audition, I lifted this straight from Scream.
Yeah,
it's
nice.
One of my favorite moments in Scream. And I got the blessings of Patrick Lussier to use it.
Really? Because
he's directed episode 2, and of course he edited all the Scream movies.
Oh, nice.
So he said, yeah, Wes would like that. Go for it.
Yeah, right.
The
Ear Fuck jingle.
Yeah, exactly. what was I talking about? Yeah, so Alan, yeah. So the piece of dialogue that was chosen for his audition piece, it was him kind of being douchey.
Yeah.
And I think initially people were worried as to whether or not he could be likable, because he needs to become kind of likable mm-hmm. by this point. I mean, especially at this point in the film. I mean, again, you know, this isn't me trashing reviewers, because I'm very much of... I started out as a critic, so, you know, mm-hmm. everybody's entitled to their opinion, and, you know, that's...
Sure.
If we all liked the same thing, then the world would be boring. But some reviews that I've read have said that the film's tone is very disjointed, and I don't think it is. To me, it's a dark comedy mm-hmm. up until the third act, where it becomes a horror movie, where Wilkes becomes a bad guy.
Yeah.
And your allegiance should very much be with these three kids.
Right, yeah. They're your grounded characters now that you've grown with.
Right.
You know?
Right. You know? Because he's stalking them. He's the bad guy at this point. He's mm-hmm. he's just killed off the other person that you like.
Yeah.
You know. I think there were just worries about David being likable, and
well, I think that shot where he's talking about, you know, we have to grind up the bones and
yeah.
like that funny moment right there really makes you go like, okay, like,
yeah.
we see where it's at. After all that, it's just like, come on, guys.
Exactly. Like, really? Exactly.
Yeah, they do. They all evolve pretty well. I like mm-hmm. that.
Seriously, that's all you have?
I loved shooting in this room. It was my favorite 2 days on the set.
Yeah.
We don't have a minute, Alan.
The incinerator was built from scratch. That was our production designer was fantastic in building something that was practical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. The night that we hung out and we were having drinks, you had just came back from filming. This
right.
day,
yeah,
and you were giddy like a school child mm-hmm. with the stuff that you know you guys did.
Yeah, I think that was the day that we cut together the first
yeah.
version of mm-hmm. that, and I showed it to you.
Yeah,
I showed it.
Right. Yeah, I was like, I don't yeah. want to say you did yeah. or you didn't, but yeah,
I did. I
yeah.
did. I showed you an early cut because mm-hmm. I was very jazzed about it.
It looks great. Yeah, like
this was the very last scene we shot on the movie.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, we had Ray and Tom for the very last day.
Mm-hmm.
We wrapped at 6 in the morning. And then I got up at 10 to go and see the noon showing of Solo to see myself as a Wookiee.
Yeah.
Because that came out, it was May 25th. It came out the same day.
You're like, what world am I living in
yeah.
right now?
I was like, yeah. I just wrapped my first feature film and now I'm a Wookiee in Star Wars. Like, what? And then we went to the wrap party afterwards. It was a very cloudy day in
yeah.
terms of my memory.
Oh.
So. This was fun to shoot because Ray kept feeling like he needed a few more takes to get it right.
I mean, his eyes were like definitely welled with
yeah.
tears, you know, to
yeah,
keep that
yeah.
going.
And that was an earlier take. And I said, and I was like, cut, we got it. And I just heard him go, no, one more. I was like, all right, one more.
Sure.
And this was the very last shot because we didn't have to worry about the sun coming up.
Right. Just get it right.
Yeah. This was very much my Blair Witch scene because to me, and I had a little bit of back and forth with Blumhouse on this shot.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it wasn't about what you see. It's about being in the casket with him and hearing what he's hearing.
Right. Don't leave to
right.
see. Yeah.
Right. You know, it's him. You know, it's Jack. You can see his mustache.
Right. Nobody else is, you know,
you know yeah, nobody else is in there. You know, and because I always think the best horror movies are an assault on the senses.
Definitely.
So this was our sound scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially considering he takes his eyes out.
Yeah.
So, doesn't matter what you see. He's not going to see anything.
That little homage earlier where he kind of gives the fake mask.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Foreshadowing.
I just remember when, because we shot him with the appliance on, so he's got an appliance where his eyes are completely
covered, yeah.
taken out. And we did a take where he was convulsing in the, he was convulsing and he was crying.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that in my original version of the film because I thought it was more distressing.
Sure, yeah.
But, I mean, especially at the point where he closes the casket there and then taps it, you can still hear him crying inside.
Oh, so brutal.
But Blumhouse were like, well, is he dead?
Right, yeah.
I was like, well, I do have a take where he's definitely dead.
Yeah.
So we went with that.
Okay.
But I just remember saying to Ray when we were doing the convulsing thing, I was like, yeah, just, you know, you've had your eyes taken out. So just, you know, convey the fear of not being able to see him, knowing that he's there, that he, you know, and
yeah,
the pain of going what you just go through. It's like, just pretend like your eyes have been taken out.
Yeah, it's kind of like that Texas chainsaw hammer to the right, head and your body's right, still...
But I just remember Ray like looking at me confused going, okay, I've never had this done to me before, but I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm sure you will, Ray.
You got it.
So this was the only scene on the film that we storyboarded,
mm-hmm,
because it was the big action set piece, and mm-hmm, I'd never directed action before, so I think it just, it put everybody at ease,
yeah,
just for me to put down on the page how it was going to look and mm-hmm, how the action beats were going to play out. And we had a wonderful stunt coordinator, Nils. He was a beast of a man, but he totally got, you know, the level of action and violence that was required for the scene, and he talked everybody through it,
mm-hmm,
so that everybody, you know, kind of came out in one piece. One thing that was really interesting about this scene, actually, in the script originally, Alan was only going to get, he was going to get stabbed in the hand with the scalpel.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was just going to get the embalming trochar in the chest, which
yeah,
would then be turned on, which does happen.
Mm-hmm.
But the he never, it wasn't until like 4 days before we started shooting that the pinky bite,
mm-hmm,
which we're seeing right now,
yeah, is
so great. I just remember giggling so hard when Tom spat it out.
Yeah.
So the last thing that I shot on that day was the insert of the finger landing in the bucket.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, that moment was, yeah, we wanted to feel that. And we had some wonderful stunt doubles on this.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where I watch this scene over and over and I forget.
Just to watch faces. Well, to see.
But I forget, like, I've seen it so many times now that I forget that the stunt doubles were even there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was so well blocked and choreographed. And, you know, I was in awe of everybody when they were working on this because, mm-hmm, you know, all I had to do was just say, okay, I want to see this,
yeah,
and this, and then go to the actors. I want you to convey this, mm-hmm, and this. And then just watching everybody kind of put it together was remarkable because this is the one scene for me, other than the finger being bitten off,
mm-hmm,
and this moment with the knife to the head, which was inspired by two things. I was thinking we've seen a lot of knives to the head, but we've never seen any blood as a result because,
right,
you know, if the knife stays in place,
it holds,
then it's going to hold the blood in. So I was thinking, what's an instance where something like that would be different? Well, I knew he was going to be convulsing because of the embalming fluid.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, what would happen if, like, you had a paint shaker with the lid off just slightly? You know, how would that look?
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, oh, it looked like a chocolate fountain. Let's do a chocolate fountain.
Yeah.
You know.
And so that scene right there, where he shows himself, he only has a glimmer of life, uh-huh, left, and he's just seeing, uh-huh, that. Like, that's the visceral part.
That's, you know, the visceral part, but the cutting part for me is the line, I hope that one drink was worth it.
Yeah.
You know, but... How does that look now, asshole? And you know what? I do not apologize for this moment in one bit.
Why?
Because it's movie physics. Everybody's bitching about the fact, oh my god, that wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I don't care, it's funny.
Yeah.
We just had this really visceral death. Mm-hmm. You know, does
and it's funny.
It's funny. Yeah. His reaction to it.
Like oh,
he can't even believe it.
Uh-huh.
But I know some people were upset that Dot deserved a better death. I shouldn't call it Dot. Aurora, get pissed at me. Sorry, mm-hmm, Aurora. Dorothy,
uh-huh,
that she deserved a better death. But I stand by it in the sense that you know, she's the Dorothy and Maggie are the only two characters that don't die by Wilkes's hand.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Dorothy went down fighting, and she ultimately caused her own death, but, you know, it wasn't at the hands of Wilkes. It wasn't on Wilkes's terms. It was on her terms.
Yeah.
You know, she chose to pull the trigger. You know, and if you watch that shot carefully, she actually fires in reaction to him already pulling the tray up.
Yeah.
Because we meticulously kind of timed that out so that it wasn't a case of him having lightning reflexes.
Right.
He pulls the tray up first, then she shoots.
Yeah, no, I think it works great. I mean, like you said, that visual kill beforehand,
right.
I mean, just to have that the comedy come it, right
yeah,
back.
We needed to bring it back to the kind of movie that it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that shot of Dorothy staring into camera on the incinerator bed and Alan's head.
I was gonna say,
down.
How is that? Like, did she blink ever?
No,
like,
no. I think we did three takes of that, and she never flinched once.
Wow.
She was absolutely fantastic. I mean, even because I think we only did the finger being put on the hand on two of the takes.
Yeah.
And on the first time we did that, because I didn't tell them that we were going to do it, and Tom put the finger down on David's hand, and then they got pushed out of frame, both of them just burst out laughing. And then that was the third take, the one that we actually used.
Gotcha.
But that was the incinerator that Cecil Gentry built. So we just pulled it out from the wall.
Okay.
And then we just had them on a wheeled gurney.
Mm-hmm.
So
wheeled them off,
yeah,
shot.
Just pushed them off, and then boom.
Nice.
This night was a pain in the ass. So this is actually a reshoot, this shot right here, from everything
really?
That you've just been seeing.
Okay.
Because shoot a movie in LA, they said.
Yeah.
It never rains in LA, they said.
No.
We got rained off on this night
shooting
the ending. And the weird part is we got rained off shooting the end to the original short.
Mm-hmm.
And the ending to the short, which was shot in a piece of woodland by Highgate Cemetery, was the same piece of the woods. Hang on. Which is a line from The Black Cat, Bela Lugosi, and Boris Karloff, that Paul Fisher wrote. So he takes the credit for that reference.
Paul Fisher's killing it on this.
There you go. so yeah, we shot the end of the short in this piece of wood by Highgate Cemetery, which the legendary 80s serial killer Dennis Nielsen buried some of his victims, and we only found out afterwards. But then when we were shooting this scene, and we got rained off. Following morning, we found out that Dennis Nielsen died in prison.
Oh my god.
How freaky is that?
Man.
So
weird vibes that being.
Uh-huh. So this moment for me was the catalyst for me agreeing to adapt the body into a feature. Because I got a little bit of criticism from the short that he just walked off scot-free at the end.
Yeah.
So I said to Paul Fisher, I was like, I'll do it, but he has to end up in the bag at the end.
Yeah.
So
I like it. Well, it just goes to show that corsets are so tight, they'll hold in any stab wounds, gunshot wounds.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, we did several different endings in the script, but it always ended with Maggie on top.
Yeah.
You know? I love this cue from the Newtons. It's one of the first ones I heard. It was great. You see the foot wheeling there? Will he come back? And this final shot was inspired by Sarah Connor in her Jeep.
Oh, yeah.
Driving off towards the storm. And Maggie's heading off to her new playground.
That's great. Oh, so fun.
So there we go.
Hey. The body. First of many films coming out in the new series for Hulu.
Yeah. Yeah, so Flesh and Blood, which is the Thanksgiving episode, comes out on Friday, which is November 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
So. And then Nacho Vigalondo's Christmas episode, Puka, which there's actually a little nod to the Puka at the very beginning of the body. The shot immediately after Wilkes leaving the lobby after the title, you've got a bus. You've got a shot of a bus.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the ad on the front of the bus, it's for the Puka toy.
Oh,
which
nice.
Which is a little nod to the Christmas episode.
So you guys knew about all the movies that were already made before the production started.
A few of them. I mean, especially at that point, when we were in post and we were doing the CG and stuff like that, they were shooting Puka.
Yeah.
So all I remember is that we got an email from the legal team saying, there's a giant ad for this insurance company on the front of the bus. Why did no one see this?
Nice.
And I was like, well, let's at least make an effort to do like a tied universe thing.
Right.
You know, and I was like, look, it's October. Mm-hmm. Toys are going to start hyping the Christmas season. Let's put the Puka toy on the front.
Right, yeah. You know?
And that's what it ended up being. So
is that the idea, that is that all these movies are in the shared universe? Was that
definitely me who said that. Whether or not they carry it on,
yeah,
I don't know. But I at least
see some broken black frame glasses in another episode. Well, you never know.
But I felt close to Nacho's episode because my producer on this, Alexa Fagan, was doing that, and mm-hmm. so was Scott Winnig. And so essentially the entire team that did the body then went on to do the Christmas episode, because Patrick Lussier's episode, I think, had already shot by that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt close to that one, so I wanted to do a little nod to Nacho.
Yeah. So. Very nice. Hulu Originals.
There we go.
Awesome. Paul, thank you very much for coming on and doing this commentary. I hope we can slap it on, and maybe when it gets its distribution overseas, we can make this audio track number 2.
There you go.
All right. Take it easy, Paul, and I'm sure I'll have you back on soon.
Thanks, man.
Next project.
There we go. Take care.